I didn't expect such a large turnout today. Honestly. Well, you got no friends now. Sad lives, huh? But you're beginning to learn how to be happy with or without. And that is a real achievement, I tell you. Where nothing in this world can shatter your peace and take away your happiness. No one, no thing, nothing. So you're truly independent. The new year is just around the corner, isn't it? A new year is a time for people to set dreams and goals for the new year. I particularly like this note, especially the last line. So it says, Swaminarayana, today would be the 30th sermon being delivered here at Gateway. 30th? Wow. Having commenced the series on the 4th of June, we are blessed and ever so grateful to you and the Anagarika Mahatturu for the untiring efforts, blah, 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 blah. And then it says, hope we will make you proud sooner than later. Now that I like. Dharmishta Rajagirians. Now that is an accolade that's worth having. The Dharmishta Rajagirians. How do you know that you are becoming Dharmishta, righteous? How can you claim to be Dharmishta? If your actions and your thoughts and your words, your speech, if all these three, your actions, thoughts and your speech, if these three things adhere to the Dhamma, if they are true to the Dhamma, if first and foremost your actions and your words and by thought you don't hurt anyone else, you're a blessing to others. By my books, that is when I know that someone is a Dharmishta person or a righteous person. Because far too many people live their lives being a botheration to other people. You know this because sometimes you have to come across people like that. When people are far too concerned about their likes and dislikes, then they have very little time to think about the implications of their actions on other people. But then, alas, there is nothing more that people can think about because they are overly consumed by themselves. As long as they perceive a self within them, then self-preservation is the main agenda of all sentient beings. But once you become one with Vipaka, once you begin to realize that all you are is just the consummation of Vipaka, the exhaustion of Vipaka, now you become one with nature. And once you become one with nature, then all sentient beings, they feel like, you feel like you're connected to all of them. It's a very special kind of connection. I feel like I'm connected to all of you. I don't even know you by your first names. I don't think I know any of your names. Maybe one or two, if you're part of the organizing committee, I might have heard it from someone. But I don't know any of you personally. But I feel a connection that goes beyond words. That is why, whatever the obstacles, whatever the challenges, you bring yourselves here, and I bring myself here, because this is a place in which I feel that connection. It is the Dhamma that connects us. And the more you practice the Dhamma, the more you will realize exactly what I mean by this. So it's great to see all these faces today, even on Christmas Eve, because Christmas is no longer, I think, just for those of that faith. I used to celebrate Christmas myself. I mean, I used to celebrate Vesak. But now, I don't have days to celebrate Christmas and Vesak and so on. Every day is Vesak for me. Vesak is a day on which you make a difference within yourself. Christmas is a day on which you celebrate harmony, peace, and the message of love and compassion and kindness to all. So every day is Christmas, isn't it? Every day is Mother's Day. Every day is Father's Day. We celebrate our mothers and fathers every day. We celebrate our teachers every day, every single day. We celebrate humanity every single day. Otherwise, soon enough, they'll have a human day on the calendar, because people will forget that they're humans, after all. World Human Day. It's soon coming. Before 2050, that'll appear on the calendar. You mark my words. World Human Day. A day on the calendar on which people can remind themselves that they're humans. But now you're different. You're becoming a citizen of the world. I want you to go beyond your thinking that you're a Sri Lankan. You're not Sri Lankans, ladies and gentlemen. You're humans. You're not Asians. You're not Buddhists. Don't segregate yourselves to anything. You're not mothers or fathers. You're not someone's brother or someone else's sister. You belong to all, and all belongs to you. Become one and all with nature. I know this is a big ask, and it's a bold claim, but that can all happen for you. The day you feel that you are connected to every stranger that you see on the road as you walk past them, the day that you can think of them just as you think of your own children, and when you look at them and you think, what is it that I can do in this moment to alleviate them from their suffering in the very same way that you feel about your own kith and kin, if you can feel that way about every man, woman and child, now you truly feel that you are a global citizen, that you're here for everyone. And then the devas will venerate you. The brahmas will venerate you. Your name will resonate in all quarters of the universe, because you will become truly universal. So I want you to start to consider yourself in that light. As we turn a new page in the new year, I mean 30 sermons, that's quite a lot. Right? 30 sessions where you have engrossed yourselves in the Dhamma and nothing else. All we talk about here is how to be a good human being and then how to go from good to great, isn't it? That's what we're talking about here. To become great, first you have to be good. But after you are good, now you have to go on to become great. Become an Aryan. Become a noble one. That is what we do here. And you will begin to realize the transformation that is happening within yourselves. And I believe that it is happening for you. And you're not just coming here because of the sales pitch. You're not just coming here because of a good performance that is given by the Swami Nuance. See, that's not a good performance. So you can't be coming here for that. You certainly can't be coming here for the sandwiches. So you must be coming here because you're experiencing an internal transformation. You're beginning to feel lighter. You're beginning to feel happier. You're beginning to feel more relaxed and at peace with yourself in your own skin. That's what you're beginning to feel. You're beginning to feel okay being you. That's what you're beginning to feel. Because that is one of the most difficult things that people have to do with, to deal with themselves. It's fine dealing with other people, but then when you have to deal with yourself, the guilt that comes out of your own actions, the desires that ignite you from inside and burn you from inside, and when you want to stop yourself from doing something but you just can't, now you have to put up with yourself, mustn't you? I mean, that is just torture. You know what I mean, because you've been there, you've done that, and you know what this feels like. And when you feel anger, and you feel like you really want to have a go at someone because they've done wrong to you, but you know it's bad, you know that you don't want to do it, but still you can't stop yourself from feeling that way. And then anger takes over. And then before you know it, you've said something that you know you're going to regret, but you can't hold yourself back because it's just bubbling inside and it has to get out, otherwise you're not going to be able to sleep tonight. You know this, you know what I'm talking about. And when someone's done something wrong to you or said something wrong to you, and there's the phone on your bedside table and it's time to go to bed, but until you get that message out of your system, you just can't fall asleep. You try turning left and right on the bed, trying to shut your eyes and to just sleep it off, but it's just not happening because so much resentment is bubbling inside. Anger, and you know soon enough it'll turn into hatred. And you start swearing among your friends, among your own people. You start saying things that you never thought would come out of your mouth. And then you begin to wonder, am I so foul-mouthed? But you can't hold yourself, because once that agenda starts to brew inside your mind, there is no refuge. But now you're beginning to learn that there is one refuge, no matter what the circumstances are. The Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, the only refuge there is. Once you take shelter under this massive tree that is the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, you can brace any storm that might come your way. Any storm. Any hurdle, any obstacle, any challenge seems insignificant. So as we take a moment to look back at how we've spent our lives over the last year, and as you prepare yourself for the upcoming year, thank yourselves for the effort that you've made to come along to these 30 sermons. It's not just Swaminarayan who did his part, and it's not just the Anagarika Mahatayas who brought the Swaminarayan here. Neither of those two things would have made any difference in your lives had you not turned up, right? And also, you have the people who brought you here to thank. Thank them with all your heart. If there was at least one talk that you thought had a profound impact on your life, remember, it is not I who came to your door, knocking on your door, saying, hey, there's a sermon on Sundays in Rajagiri. Do you want to come along? I don't even know where you live. But someone rang you. Someone sent you a text. Someone sent you an email. Someone made an invitation to you. Someone said, let's go on a trip. And then they tricked you into coming here. But somehow, you ended up here. And you have everyone around you to thank for that. Maybe the person who brought you here doesn't come here anymore. That happens. That happens quite a lot. Oh, I've seen that so many times in my life. People they bring along, people to the sasana. The people that they bring along, they remain as anagarikas. Sometimes they go on to become monks, and they fulfill the path. And they end up becoming arahants. But the people who brought them there, they're gone. That happens sometimes. So you got to thank your lucky stars. That's just how vipaka works. So that might have happened for some of you. But whatever your story is, we are turning a new page. So thank yourself for being here. Thank those who invited you and brought you along. Excuse me. Thank the doctors who try and keep me fit enough to bring myself here every Sunday. Everyone. This is a collective effort. That is why it would be unwise and foolish for any one of us, including myself, to think that this is my doing. Nothing could be more foolish than that. This is not any one of our doing. This is a collective effort. This is all our good vipaka coming together to fruition. Each and every one of you is being healed, ladies and gentlemen, every day you come here. And so am I. Because in healing others, you're healed. That's the way it works. Of course, we have our noble teachers to thank for that. We have the Dhamma to thank for that. And we have the perfect one to thank for that. Because if there was anyone who did it all by himself, it's none of us. But there was one. The one. He had no teacher. He had no guide. He had no one to inspire him. No one to motivate him. No one to guide him along. No one to tell him what was right from wrong. Out of his own perfections, practiced and honed over many, many, many lifetimes, he accumulated enough merits to realize the Dhamma on his own. I mean, come on, think about that. See how difficult it is to understand the Dhamma even when you have someone explaining it to you? On the way back last week, I was asking Swami Nanda, how was today's sermon? And he's telling me, where did you start and where did you end? And he was right. I thought to myself, you know, some of these concepts that I just start, you know, throwing at you so freely, I sometimes forget that these are concepts that we have never discussed before. But then I think, well, it must be obvious to you because it's obvious to me. So you also have the Swami Nivasa to thank for being here and keeping me on track and not getting too carried away. So he said, Swami Nivasa, you had better go over what you talked about last week because there were some very deep and profound concepts that this was the first time this audience would have heard you say, and it's not fair to expect people to understand all that in one sitting. And I was thinking of taking the next chapter of the book. But he's reminded me we had better go over some of those concepts. So we'll do that today as well. Anyhow, the long and the short of all of that is, this is not any one person's doing. This is not a one-man band. This is a collective and joint effort. Our good merits, all of us, coming together. But of course, as we think of the perfect one, the supremely enlightened one, the fully awakened one, he who had no teacher, no guide, no master, no footsteps to follow, he who had to pave the path all for himself, when the whole world was standing against him, Mara never comes and wages war with us, ladies and gentlemen. For us, you know, for the Mara, we are just puny insignificances. But Mara only wages war with one individual. Because he says, the world is mine, these people are their mine, these are my subjects. You know who the Mara was speaking of? You. The Mara says, these are my subjects. Let these people live. Live on. Yes, they needn't do bad things, but let them do good things, good deeds, meritorious deeds, and let's just let them carry on. Let them vex. So what? There are opportunities to relieve themselves from vexation, and then they can experience pleasure. Why not? Let them carry on. Let them live on. The Mara goes and challenges the Buddha. He says, these are my people. How dare you try and take them out of samsara? And the Buddha says what? Shut up. Go and tell that to people who don't have merits to come across a Buddha. They are your people. But those who have accumulated enough merits to listen to the teaching of the Buddha, to come across his teaching, to understand his teaching and to comprehend it, and thereby to save themselves from suffering and achieve ultimate salvation, they, Embamara, are my people. So it is for them I open my mouth. It is for them I speak the Dhamma. It is for them I turn the wheel of Dhamma once, and it will forever turn. As long as there is at least one noble person in this sensual world, the wheel of Dhamma that I turn today will forever turn. And there is not a soul in this world that can unturn it, stop it, or reverse it. What a bold claim. That is the Buddha. So to his holy name, let us bring our palms together in veneration. As we renew our pledge of allegiance to the Buddha, as we renew our oath to free ourselves from suffering, to walk the path that he laid down for us so clearly, the pristine Dhamma still prevails. Ladies and gentlemen, let us be grateful for that. Bringing our palms together in veneration, let us pay respect to his holy name.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Shall I give you some evidence of the fact that change is happening in your lives? This is just one example. At the end of last week's talk, someone came up to me and they said, "Swami Nuhansa, with the help of the Mahasangha, I'm now beginning to understand the Dhamma little by little, and I want to set aside more of my time and dedicate myself a little bit more, as much as I possibly can, to practicing the Dhamma, practicing the path and working myself towards Nibbana. So what I've planned to do is go on a meditation retreat, and when I get there I'll be reflecting on what you have taught me, and hopefully the time I spend there will help me to reflect on the Dhamma and help me make progress on the path." So they came to one to take my blessings, but secondly they said, "Swami Nuhansa, but there is a little problem." I said, "What?" "You're about to do a fantastic thing, but what's the problem?" "My mother's not feeling too well." "And right now there's no one to really look after her. And normally I wouldn't think twice about doing something like this. If I want to do something, I would normally do it. But on this occasion, my mother has taken a turn for the worse. She is now feeling a bit poorly. What must I do, I'm thinking? Should I think about her and stay at home? Because if I go on this retreat, then there's not going to be anyone to look after her. She can fend for herself, but by the time I get back, she will feel even more rough, and she will need me. She'll need someone to be by her side. So what should I do? I've already made the booking. I didn't realize that this was going to happen, but the circumstances have changed. What would you suggest I do in these circumstances? Do I think about myself, as you always say? You know, you do a lot for other people, but what about your own salvation? Do I do that, or do I look after my mother and be by her side? But I don't know when the next retreat might be. Maybe I might not get a chance again for a long time. So what should I do?" So, as I was listening to this person explain to me the problem, I thought for a moment and I wondered, I tried to understand the sentiment with which this person spoke. Of course, the words are one, but the emotion behind that is what conveys the whole picture, isn't it? So I really recognized that in this person's heart, all they could think was what Swami Mahasaya taught us on the first talk, paying gratitude. Being grateful to the people who are responsible for my being able to practice the Dhamma, to be here today, and to even consider going on a retreat. So I said, what would you like to do, but what's getting in the way? Well, she's my mother after all. But then I understand if I choose to stay at home, this retreat may never come again in my life. It was with much difficulty I organized this program, but I may never get another chance. This is why I am on the horns of a dilemma right now. So I take I'm looking for your guidance, Swami Nahasa. And all I said was, you look after your mother and let me look after you. I was so utterly impressed by the fact that this person felt the need to actually come and ask, Swami Nahasa, what must I do on this occasion? Because there's you telling me that I have to work on my salvation, work on my practice, work on Nibbana, and how precious life is, right? And life is not a never-ending lease of life. You never know when it's going to come to an end. And I've managed to get myself on this retreat. But then, of course, you also tell us that we have to fulfill our duties and our responsibilities and obligations. So, what do I do? I was so impressed by the fact that your duty and your responsibility, especially towards your parents, that came first. This is why I say your practice of the Dhamma, your understanding and comprehension of the Dhamma, I don't test by giving you a paper, a question paper. I don't give you a test in the Paticchasamuppada. What I check is how much of a blessing you are to the people that are around you. Because you see, ladies and gentlemen, your practice of Dhamma, of the Dhamma, can happen anywhere, anytime, any place. That is what we're trying to do here. If you have to be at the temple for that, if you have to be at a retreat center for that, then there is something not quite right with the way that you have grasped the Dhamma. Because the Dhamma is to be applied in every single sight that comes through your eyes, every single sound that comes through your ears, every taste, every touch, every smell, every thought. There are no thoughts to which you cannot apply the Dhamma. There are no sights to which you cannot apply the Dhamma, because the Dhamma is the truth. The truth is the truth is the truth, and the truth applies to everything that is out there. But I didn't stop there. So, usually when I'm impressed, when I hear such things, I take it to my teacher. So I went and saw him. I went to see him last week when I headed back to the monastery. And I said, Guru Andhra, guess what one of the people who come to the sermons came and told me today. And I explained to him what had happened. And then he said, you're impressed by what I say, right? You've got to wait and hear what he has to say. And then he said, isn't it time we arranged a meditation retreat at the monastery for the Rajagirians? That's what he says. So he has now advised me to organize a program, initially a one-day program. We will find a suitable and convenient time for most of you at someday in the new year, where the whole day will be dedicated for all of you. So you will come along, you can come in the morning, whatever time we can work out to be convenient for you. And throughout the day, there will be a program where you can listen to the Dhamma, you can meditate, you can practice, and you will get instruction from monks So you'll even try and organize little small group sessions whereby you can ask your specific questions in the Dhamma. So this is what Guru Hamadru had to say. All because of one person. Now tell me that's me. Tell me I can take credit for all of this. Of course I can. This is because one person among you felt that the real practice of Dhamma should be where you put others before yourself. That compassion and kindness that you have, that you can extend to all sentient beings, where you don't put your needs in front of others. Because Nibbana is Nibbana. There is no such thing called my Nibbana and someone else's Nibbana. What we learn to do, ladies and gentlemen, is do Nibbana everywhere. Nibbana is everywhere. Nibbana is the truth. Where is the truth? It's everywhere, isn't it? So you have earned yourself a very special day soon to come at the monastery. And once we've put a few of the plans together, I will announce a date in the new year. I'll give you enough to notice so you can set aside that day, because I know you've all got very busy schedules. And then you can come along and experience a day at the monastery. So don't thank me for that. That's not my doing. All I did was take your message to Guru Hamadru, and then that is what Guru Hamadru has given back to you as a gift for your kindness and your altruistic thoughts. That is really something. What I want to teach you, what I want to help you understand, ladies and gentlemen, is how you can apply the Dhamma wherever you are, no matter the circumstances, in whatever situation. Because if you can learn to do that, then Dhammo have rakkati dhammachari everywhere. A dhammachari is someone who is always contemplating on the Dhamma. I want you to be able to do that everywhere, anywhere, at all places, all times. Excuse me. If you're awake, that is a moment in which you can contemplate on the Dhamma. The only time where you cannot contemplate on the Dhamma is where you're asleep, or if you're in a coma. These situations, we have to pass. But every other situation, if you're awake, it matters not what you're doing. Even while you're driving, while you're walking, while you're speaking, you can practice this. If you practice this well enough, even as you're speaking with someone and you're having a conversation of something unrelated to the Dhamma, you can still be contemplating on the Dhamma. Let me prove that to you. See, there are two types of Dhamma. One is called Dhamma and the other is called Adhamma. One kind of Dhamma is the Dhamma that leads you to freedom from suffering, and the other kind of Dhamma constantly keeps you in suffering. And by suffering, I mean the suffering that always prevails. It's always there. It's not just the suffering that you experience when you grieve for someone's loss. Right? I'm not just talking about that suffering. I'm talking about the constant suffering. There's a constant suffering that's happening within your minds even as we speak. No matter what you do, it's always there. This is the constant suffering of existence. When do you exist? When you do what do you exist? Exactly, right? You always exist. So for as long as you feel that you exist, suffering is there. This is the suffering of what the Buddha terms as jati. We'll discuss these concepts as we continue our talks. So this suffering is always there. You see, for jati to happen, like all things, there must be the right causes. Because cause and effect is a phenomenon that applies to all things. It's a universal phenomenon. It doesn't just apply to, you know, physics. It applies to everything. It doesn't just apply to a fire. Cause and effect, yes, you understand the causes and how it leads to a fire. But it's not just that. It applies to everything. So if it applies to everything, then I've got some really good news for you. It also applies to suffering. Why is that good news? Why is it good news that suffering is based in causes? Because then, once you deal with the causes, suffering is dealt with. Yeah? That's the great thing about the principle of cause and effect. You don't need to worry about the effect. You don't need to deal with the effect. You don't need to undo the effect. Let the effect be. Work on the causes. Once you work on the causes, the effect will be dealt with. You don't need to concern yourself about the effects at all. Take a simple example. Take friendship, for instance. Friendship is a feeling that you have towards someone that you adore. And hopefully it's a mutual feeling. Yeah? So, if there's a time in life where you feel that, you know, your friendship is not as strong as it used to be, for instance. Okay? Say, you're not feeling that vibe from the other person. And they're not talking to you like they used to, you know, you're not exchanging gifts, you're not seeing each other so much like you used to. Right? And as I say this, I think examples will start popping up into your mind. Oh yes, I know that one. What do we do about it? Friendship is the effect. Worry not about the effect. Focus on the causes. What are the causes that lead to friendship? What has happened to your goodwill? What about the time where you had a bit of an argument and then normally you would be the first person to step in and say, hey, you know what, let's forget it. You know, you and I, we are best buddies. Why do we worry about things like this? Let it go. Water under the bridge and you move on. But last time that happened, no one took the first step to do that. So now it's still there. Whenever the two of you meet, it's you know, it's a skeleton in the closet. It's always there. You just didn't deal with that. So what you could do in the new year, for instance, if there's a friend that you really used to get along with, you know, if you continue to get along with them, perhaps today they'd be sat next to you. See what a loss it is for them that you fell out with them? Interesting sidetrack. I'll come back to the main point in just a moment. You are a different species now. Okay? It used to be that it would be the others. Sorry. It used to be that it would be your loss when you fell out with one of your friends. Used to be. Because you had a lot more to get from others than perhaps they did to get from you. But now the tables have turned. Things are a little bit different now. So here's what I urge you to do in the new year. If there are people who you don't see eye to eye anymore with, it could be your friends, maybe it could be your own siblings. Ring a bell? Maybe it's a cousin. Maybe it's your nephew. Maybe someone you used to go to school with, they used to be best buddies, but now far too busy. You just went your own ways and now you're not seeing each other much at all. But it used to be that, you know, you were okay with that because, you know, they're just another fish in the ocean. But I suggest in the new year, out of compassion, you change that. Because you are a different species now. To get to know you is now a privilege. Don't you agree? Why is the person that sat next to you here today? Or maybe the person sat two rows ahead of you or two rows behind you here today? It is because you brought them along. Why are you here today? Because there's someone somewhere else in the audience who invited you to come here today. Was it not a privilege, an honor to know them? So that today you have come across the Buddha's teaching? Now then tell me, are you the same person that you used to be? Or have you not become far more valuable to associate with, to know, to have in your circle of friends than the person that you used to be? So then out of compassion I say, out of kindness I say, if there are those who you don't get along with as much as you used to, but now it is their loss, ladies and gentlemen, not yours anymore, because now you're getting the elixir of Dhamma and I'm helping you to become free and become independent from all such things. Whereby once you have the Dhamma, Dhamma have rakati Dhammachara, you no longer need your friends to protect you. Sometimes you might not even need your family to protect you. Yes, you might need them to provide for you, in some ways, right? Maybe give you the requisites that you need for sustenance, but for your own mental happiness, soon enough, you won't need your wife. Uh-oh. Well, isn't that what you would want for your husband? I ask the wives here. If you truly love your husband, do you not want him to be happy no matter what happens in your relationship? If you truly love your wife, what would you now give her on your anniversary as a gift if she has not listened to the Dhamma yet? Huh? Wouldn't you bring her along? Maybe send her a link along with the bouquet of flowers and the box of chocolates. Don't you think there's something else that you have to give her? You know, if a man truly loves someone else, another man, if a man truly cares for another man, if a man truly has loving kindness and compassion towards someone else, right, this is the best gift that someone can give. You're becoming noble ones. 1 week at a time. 1 day at a time. 1 contemplation at a time. So please, don't take yourself away from the people that associate you, because you are becoming a blessing to them. I'm helping you realize your true worth. Perhaps you're professionals in your own professions. If you're a teacher, yes, your students need you. I agree. But you're not the only one who knows how to teach science. You're not the only one who knows how to teach math or physics or chemistry. You're not the only one who teaches French. There are many more French teachers out there. But there aren't many people out there who understand and practice the Dhamma. There are those who learn the Dhamma, they know the Dhamma, but they don't practice it, and therefore they cannot be a vehicle of the Dhamma. To be someone who is a messenger, you have to be the message. So as you are beginning to internalize the teaching of the Buddha, ladies and gentlemen, I urge you in the new year, if there are those bridges that need mending, you take the first step. Do it out of compassion. They will thank you for it. But you don't do it to get their thanks. You do it out of compassion. If there's a brother that you haven't seen in a long time, maybe there was a rift in the family, you don't see eye to eye. Perhaps, you know, today you have become a dharmishta person, but he has become an adharmishta person. You can change that. A few words can make a big difference in a person's life. Have you not experienced that personally? You came here on the second week because of the first week. So 1 week was enough to get you, bring you back another week. And that week was enough to bring you back another week. And look at what's happened. Now you keep coming along. Now I can't get you to even stop. See, things are happening for you. The Dhamma is having its effect on you. So therefore, don't distance yourself from the people that you really care about. They need you in their lives. Disagree with me if you can. The people around you need you in their lives more than you need them. Don't you agree? Because now you are a messenger of the Buddha. Because you see, now you don't say things, you don't say harsh things to hurt their feelings. You're not a menace to them anymore. You're a blessing to them. You talk to them about kindness. You talk to them about compassion. You talk to them about anicca, dukkha and anatta. I mean, come on. These are the 3 most rare things in this whole universe. It is only once the Buddha comes along do people get to even hear this, let alone contemplate on it and practice it. So therefore, if there are those relations in your families, then normally, you know, it's typically in the new year, we generally give people, our friends, a call and, you know, wish them a new year and all that, right? And this year's list may be different to last year's list, Maybe this year's Christmas card list is shorter than last year's Christmas card list, whatever. But I tell you, if there are those who you feel will benefit from the Dhamma, think of it in that light. If there are those who you know are good people, right? They're easy to change. Good people. They don't walk around being a bother and a nuisance to everyone else. You know, they're good people, but they just haven't come across the teaching. Just like who you were 30 weeks ago. But you had the good fortune to come across someone, a noble associate. So now you have become a noble associate. Give that association to somebody else. Give the gift of Dhamma. Sabbadanam, you know it. What? Dhammadanam, jinati. The greatest gift of all is the gift of Dhamma. Count your fortune by the number of hearts you heal, ladies and gentlemen. What a good feeling that is. If you can count the number of hearts you've healed by the time you leave this earth, and you can consider yourself, you're living in this world to have been a blessing to others. Like I reminded you last week, there's the $1 with which you buy a bar of chocolate and you give it to a child, and then there's the million that you keep in your bank account. Which one do you take with you? The $1. You only take what you give. What you hoard, you don't take with you. Someone else will take it from you. There's only one way to turn vipaka into karma. In other words, to take your vipaka with you. If you want to take your vipaka with you, good or bad, it applies both ways. It applies both ways. If someone, say, comes and hits you, or shouts at you, or someone does something to annoy you, that is a vipaka. If it hurts your feelings, right, you can consider that to be a karma, a bad karma in the past, done in the past, and then now it's coming to you as a vipaka. You have a choice in this moment. If you react to this, what you're doing is, you're putting it back in the bank account. Because you've just made a withdrawal, but if you react to this, if you go tit for tat, if you go an eye for an eye, then it goes back into the bank account. Because your mind is the perfect recycling machine. It does it so wonderfully. It can even magnify it and amplify it, depending on how much raga, dvesha and moha you have in that moment. Remember the story of Sarivanija and Kachaputa? The two traders. So this is the first time the Buddha came across Devadatta in his time in samsara. So you briefly remember the story where the Bodhisattva, he was a tradesman. Excuse me. And so was Devadatta back then. They were both tradesmen. So they went around selling their merchandise. And then, very randomly walked past a certain house, and there was a young girl at the house with her grandmother. So they were very poorly. They didn't have much money. They were very poor people. So this girl, she wanted what? She wanted some bangles. A very poor girl. She wanted some bangles though. So she saw that there was this seller that was selling bangles, and she wanted some bangles, so she asked her grandmother, "Achyamma, please, can I have some bangles?" And the grandmother said, "We can't afford it. We don't have enough money even to keep the wolf from the door. How can I buy you any bangles? How can I buy you any jewelry? That's a luxury for us." And then she kept on weeping and crying for it. So the poor grandmother, she felt very distraught at the daughter's crying and weeping for it. So what did she do? She summoned the tradesman and she said, "Mr. Sir, please can you give my young granddaughter some bangles?" And then he said, "Well, yes, I can do if you pay for it." And then the grandmother says what? I don't have anything to pay you with. But my granddaughter is crying. I need some bangles for her. Out of compassion, is there anything that you could do? And then he said, unfortunately not. So he was not very kind, he was not very generous. And then the grandmother, so that the young girl remembered that there was an old plate back in the kitchen. But this was not any old plate. It was a plate of gold. This was the only thing that was of any material value that was at home. And so she went into the kitchen and she grabbed it. She didn't know that this was gold. She showed it to the grandmother and said to the grandmother, Archie, perhaps we can exchange this for a few bangles. And the grandmother didn't realize that it was made of pure gold either, because it was quite dusty and it looked very old. So she gave it to the merchant and she said, how about this? Maybe you can give me a few bangles, two or three bangles in exchange for this. So this man, who was an opportunist, he realized that this was an actual gold plate, worth much more than all of the merchandise that he had with him. But he was a wicked man. Old habits die hard. So he was a wicked man. And he realized this was the perfect opportunity, because these two women, this grandmother and the child, they're so gullible. They don't know what they're offering in exchange for a few bangles. So what did he do? He said, well, this plate is not worth anything at all. I don't want this. Give me something valuable. Give me some money and I might consider selling you some bangles. But this is worthless. All the while, he was coming up with a cunning plan to try and get this plate off of them. So the grandmother kept on beseeching, but the tradesman, the merchant, was not willing to play. And he said, well, you know what, keep it with you. This is not worth anything. I'll go on my journey and try and sell as many of the bangles that I can. Whatever is left, I might come back and maybe give you one or two, if there's any left by the time I've done my rounds. So the grandmother tried to pacify the girl and said, unfortunately, you know, we don't have anything of value. We are very poor. So there's nothing we can do, my little girl. Stop crying. So the girl went back in the house. But she couldn't help crying, because when she wants bangles, she wants bangles. And then came along the Bodhisattva, who was also a merchant. He was also carrying with him lots of this jewelry stuff, bangles and rings and all sorts of things and necklaces and so on. So as he came along, he was also stopped by the grandmother, because the young girl saw this merchant as well. And she tried to get the grandmother to ask this merchant to come along as well, and so he did. And then the grandmother said, sir, there was one merchant who came before you, and I tried to get him to give us some bangles in exchange for an old plate that we have at home. That is all we have. We have nothing more of value. Please, would you kindly give a few bangles to my young girl here, because she's distraught and all she wants is that, and I can't seem to pacify her until I give her some. So this man, the Bodhisattva, says, okay, bring it and let me see what you have. So the granny went back in and she fetched the plate. As soon as this merchant held the plate, who's this merchant now? The Bodhisattva. As soon as he held the plate, his eyes began to gleam. And he said, good Lord, I've never seen quite something like this. This is a plate of pure gold. Not all the material possessions that I have to my name can I give you in exchange for this. This is priceless. See, he was being truthful. This is priceless. There is nothing that I have that I can give you in exchange for this. Even if I give you the clothes that I'm clad in and everything else I own, that I still haven't given you enough for this plate if I were to exchange it for that. And the grandmother said, what? That's not what I heard from the previous merchant. He said this was worth nothing. Well, I don't know about what he said, but I can tell you, madam, that this plate is priceless. So, here's all the bangles. I feel bad about doing this because I can't give you enough in exchange for the price of this plate, but here's all of the bangles and everything I own, and here's all the money that I've made selling the bangles selling the jewelry that I've done so far. Here's all my material possessions. If you want, you can give me the plate in exchange for that. And so the grandmother complied. So he got the plate and he gave up all of the merchandise he had to the young girl. Of course, she was very happy, didn't expect any of this to happen. And now, this merchant with the golden plate, he starts to head back because his deal is done. He has no more merchandise to sell, so now he heads back. So this was Kachaputta, our Bodhisattva. Serivanaja, the other guy, he comes back now. What's he looking for this time round? To try and get the plate on the cheap. So he comes back and stops by the old grandmother's house and says, "Hey, you still there? Do you still want a few bangles? Yeah, why don't you give me that plate? I feel generous right now. So I might give you a few bangles in exchange for that." And the grandmother. Have you seen your grandmother when she gets angry? This grandmother, she came out. So, Serivanaji, is a Bodhisattva. Are you sure? It is it? Okay, so I got the names confused. You're probably right. Thank you. So, Serivanaja is the Bodhisattva, Kachaputta is the Devadatta, okay? That's not how I remember it, but it's fine. You know, it's just a name after all. Thank you for correcting me. So now, Kachaputta comes looking for the plate. And then, the grandmother gives her a piece of her mind. Not the plate. She says, "How dare you? You tried to cheat me out of it. You gave me all these lies. And you said this was worth nothing. And a merchant came just a few minutes after you had left. And he gave us everything that he owned. And he still said that all of this is not enough to exchange, to give you in return for the golden plate. It was made of pure gold and you lied to me." And upon hearing this, of course, now Kachaputta realizes that he's been caught red-handed. And then he asks, "Where did that merchant go?" Because what does he want now? To regain possession of the plate. Because that is all he wanted. He set his eyes on it and he was just coming up with a conniving plan to get it and keep the bangles as well. See, this is what happens when you're too greedy. You lose everything. Good lesson in life. Never be too greedy. How greedy is good greedy? How much is good greed? Just a little bit, right? So he asked, "Where did the merchant go?" And the grandmother said, "Well, he went across the river. That's why I saw him go that way. And he was a fine man, a gentleman. And unlike you, don't you ever come back here." So Kachaputta, now having heard where Serivanaja had gone, he runs after. He drops everything and he runs after him. Because he wants to regain possession of this plate on which he had set his eyes. So by the time he gets to the bank of the river, he realizes that Serivanaja was already halfway along the river onto the other side. So he calls out to the ferryman, because of course that is the only way that he can get him to turn back. He says, "Ferryman, stop! Stop the boat! Turn round and come back. That man there, he's got my plate. I want it back." Now this ferryman, he was true to his word. So he'd already taken a passenger and he was ferrying him across. So he said, "No, I'm not going to turn around because I have to do my duty." So the two just carried on. But Kachaputta now He was very angry, with full of hatred in his heart. What did he do? He bent down to the ground. He picked up a handful of sand. He threw it up in the air and he said, "For each and every grain of sand in this handful that I have thrown up in the air, I will come after you. Time after time, birth after birth, I will come after you to avenge you. To take my revenge on you as you have stolen my golden plate. You have stolen, you have taken what belongs to me. I will come after you until my last breath." And from there on, he harbored hatred against the worst person you could harbor hatred. I mean, if you're going to hate anyone, don't hate the Bodhisattva. That's the last person you ought to hate, right? And hold a grudge against? Because it is only the Bodhisattva that will one day go on to become a Buddha and will have the medicine to heal you out of your own hatred. But what about when you hate the very person? What about when you fall out with your doctor? So the worst person he could have picked that grudge against, he did on that day. And then from there on, every Jataka story that you will have read will have a story about how the Devadatta and the Bodhisattva were always at odds with each other. In fact, it was never the Bodhisattva. He always had compassion and loving kindness towards all sentient beings. But in every single story, you know what? In every single story, the Bodhisattva had Devadatta to thank, because it is thanks to his animosity, it is thanks to his grudge, it is thanks to his ill will that he harbored against the Bodhisattva was able to practice compassion. He was able to practice wisdom. He was able to practice kindness and generosity and charity. Because for there to be good, there has to be what? There has to be bad. When are you seen to be kind people? When you're among what? When you're among whom? Unkind people. You're seen to be generous when you're among the miserly. You seem to be kind when you're among the unkind. You seem to be gentle when you're among the rowdy. That's always the way it is. So the Bodhisattva, I mean, we have the Devadatta to thank as well for giving us a Buddha. Because had it not been for Devadatta, where would the Buddha or the Bodhisattva have had chances to practice his perfections? So the Dasa Parami Dharma, he practiced every single time in every single birth, because on every occasion the Devadatta had something or the other to do against the Bodhisattva. When Vipaka comes your way, ladies and gentlemen, the way to keep bringing it back to you is if you do a karma in exchange, in return for it. So if someone has a go at you, if someone does something against you, if you retaliate, what you are doing on every occasion is depositing that back into your bank account, and then you will have to repay it again. That's the way it works. Good as well as bad. Which goes to prove my point. Your good vipakas have brought you everything that you enjoy today. A good family, good children, a comfortable life, your wealth, your property, whatever, your good health, your good looks, all of that is all thanks to your good karma. The only way to have it back again is if you give it away. Because every time you give it, it goes back into your karma bank. Whatever you deposit, you're able to get a return for it. That is the way wise people invest. But what do fools do? Fools just keep on spending what they have. Whatever they get, they just keep on spending. They don't do it with the intention of giving someone or helping someone else, giving someone else a chance. Now, for instance, there may be those among you who employ people to help you with your work, right? Maybe it's a housemaid, or maybe if you have a company, an organization, there are those who work for you, and that's perfectly fine. You know, when you pay their wages, when you give them something, maybe perhaps at the end of the, you know, as the new year comes up, and it's the end of the year, maybe you want to give them something to thank them, to appreciate them for all their hard work. Do it with all your heart. As you do it, ladies and gentlemen, think about how you're making a profound impact on someone's life. Do it with all your heart. Fill your heart with goodness. Don't ever do it thinking to yourself, wretched people, I have to give them something. It's the new year now, isn't it? Why can't they just work and not ask for a pay? Never do it like that. Because remember, if they're good staff, if you have a good staff, it's not just because they're good. You have good merits. That is why you have good staff. Because not every employer, not every boss is fortunate enough to have a good team working for them. Some people, they thieve. They nick, they steal from their workplace and you don't even know it. Some people, they cut corners. And you know how difficult it is nowadays to find good staff. But that is not entirely their fault. If you are a good employee, if you are a good person, if you are someone who looks after your people, not just now, but also in previous lives as well. Because good begets good. Kindness begets kindness. So whenever you have to give them a pay rise, or you give them their wages, you give them a bonus, whatever the case might be. Or even at the end of the year, you know, you give them a plate of food and you say, Happy New Year. Whatever. Even if you give them a Christmas present. Do it with all your heart. No matter what you have to give. Remember the other day I was talking about taxes and paying your taxes? Yeah, don't ever do it out of resentment. I mean, you have to pay it anyway. Why do you resent? If you have to give it with all your heart. I'm not saying pay more than what you owe. You pay what you owe. Just pay your dues. That's fine. But as you do it happily. Because then you're doing it rejoicingly. You're doing it gladly. If you give something happily, you get it back. But if you give something unhappily, if you give something because it has to be given, if you give something out of spite, remember what you're giving is spite. You're not actually giving the thing that you're giving. You know, physical giving, ladies and gentlemen, has no intrinsic value whatsoever. Chetanaham bhikkave kammam vadami. Your karma is your chetana. Chetana is not in what you give. It's not in the physical object that you give, is it? Chetana is your volition. Chetana is your intention. Intention is purely mental. So whatever thoughts you have when you give, whatever emotions you have when you give, whatever intention you have when you give, that is the real giving. This is why the size of what you give has no significance. It matters not how big it is what you give. If you give with a big heart, you've given it all. I heard a nice story recently. You heard of the Anathapindika. Yes, he was also called Sudatta. So Anathapindika was the chief benefactor of the Buddha Sasana. He was one of the few people the Buddha himself went forward to greet. I mean, just think about that. When you walk into the Jetavanarama, do you think the Buddha is going to come and say, Oh, Mrs. Samarasekara, nice to see you. You think the Buddha is going to get up and leave his chambers and come and greet you? No, we are not so fortunate. But the Anathapindika, or Sudatta, as he was called, he was one of those people who had so much merit that the Buddha himself went forward to greet him. And as he went along, he was saying to his disciples, this man is the one who will go on to become the chief benefactor of the Sambuddha Sasana in my dispensation. So the Buddha knew who he was going to meet. But do you know his story? I'm reminding you how your investments are what is going to bring you your returns. Remember, that million in the bank account is not going to get you anything. But that 1 cent, if you give it with a big heart, and remember, it doesn't have to be money. And I'm going to prove that to you, that it doesn't have to be money. Many, many, many lifetimes ago, Anathapindika was born a young girl. Is it a girl or a boy? Boy. No, it's not a girl, a boy. He was born a young, he must have been born several times as a girl as well, but on this particular occasion, he was born a boy, a young boy. Now, in this time, ladies and gentlemen, there were no Buddhas around. There were no Buddhas. It was a time where the world was void of Buddhas. Can you imagine a world like that? Unlike the time that we are in now. Because in this time, although a Buddha is not physically present, his teaching prevails. And it will for the next 2,500 years. But after that, will again be an era where there is no Buddha. There are no Buddhas. Never dream or hope to be born in a time like that. But this was one such time. But however, in that time, there were what they were called Pacheka Buddhas. So typically, you don't have the two of them coming to this world at the same time. You will usually have a Samma Sambuddha or you will have Pacheka Buddhas. And usually, Pacheka Buddhas, they come in groups. So it's not just one Pacheka Buddha. Generally, there are quite a few Pacheka Buddhas during the time of their advent. So in this time, there was a particular Pacheka Buddha, and he used to go on alms to the village. So there was a child who used to wake up every morning, and when it was their playtime, they used to go into the garden and play making kompittu. You know what kompittu is? Thank you. I don't have one to show you today. So it's when you take some mud, yeah, and you usually take a coconut shell, you fill it with that, turn it around, and you tap it, and say, kompittu idiyang, kompittu idiyang. You've done this? If you haven't, then go back and do it. You haven't lived your childhood if you have never made a kompittu, right? Go back home today and make a kompittu. So this child, he used to make kompittu. And when he saw the Pacheka Buddha coming on alms, and he saw people going and making offerings to the Pacheka Buddha, he was thinking to himself, oh, but I don't have anything to offer. There's no food at home, nothing left over. What can I do? But I really want to offer something to this Pacheka Buddha. Now, he didn't even know that this was a Pacheka Buddha. What he realized was this was a mendicant. He was a monk. He was a virtuous person. And he wished he had something to offer to him. So he ran after this monk, and he asked him, please, venerable sir, I'm delighted to see that there are those who are making offerings to you, and how I wish I had something to offer you, but alas, I don't have anything. Although, I do have the kompittu, can I offer that to you? So the Pacheka Buddha remained silent. The boy runs back, and he gets his kompittu. And he comes up to the Pacheka Buddha. Now what is this? This is just soil, isn't it? Edible? No, it's inedible. You can't eat this stuff. But this young child, he has so much joy and devotion and respect towards the Pacheka Buddha. He just wants to offer something. Just like you people. He just wants to offer something. So the Pacheka Buddha stood there with his alms bowl, covered with his robe, and the child has his kompittu, and he really wants to offer this to the Pacheka Buddha. And the Pacheka Buddha takes a moment to examine the child's mind, because he wants to see whether he's just trying to mock him, which would not be very good for him, or whether he's actually doing this genuinely. Is this a genuine offering of devotion? So the Pacheka Buddha examines this child's mind, and he realizes that this child is actually making an offering out of sheer devotion, respect, and utmost regard. I'm trying to prove the point that what you offer is not what is significant. How much is a kompittu these days? What's the market value? It is worth absolutely nothing. A kompitu is worth nothing. It's just the soil that you tread on. But the Pachyeka Buddha examines the child's mind and realizes that this child wishes to offer this out of his whole heart. And so what does he do? He extends the alms bowl. And he says, off you go, child. There you go. And the child offers the kompitu into the Pachyeka Buddha's alms bowl. Now this kompitu is alongside the other food that the Pachyeka Buddha had received by that time. You'll have heard a similar story of the great elder Kashyapa. Remember? Where he went to see a leper. And as he was offering something, a finger fell into his alms bowl. Yeah, these are the great stories of great men who've lived in the past. These are our ancestors, ladies and gentlemen. These are our forefathers. How much we have to learn from them. So, now the Pachyeka Buddha has received his alms offering and he turns around and now he realizes that the child is waiting to see him eat his offering. Also like you. When you take something to the monastery, to the temple, and you offer it to your for the alms, the Swami knows he has to eat it, right? Otherwise, it doesn't make you happy. So these days, you can't tell Swami knows is off to, you know, for being the size of a barrel. Because what can they do? You know, 10 people come to the temple and they offer something, the Swami knows has to eat something of everything. Otherwise, how do you please them? I remember being a lay person, so I know what that feels like. Even at home, right, when you have a gathering and you've cooked something and you made extra effort to make something, right, they have to eat it, otherwise you're not happy. Now this child was the same. He had this kompitu that was offered to the Pachyeka Buddha and he wasn't going to be happy until he saw him consume it. Now of course this is only soil, so how can you eat soil? You can't. But what did the Pachyeka Buddha do? He takes his alms bowl, he walks up to the side of a tree, he sits under the shelter, and he performs an irdi. This is a miracle. So once you've trained the mind, you can do this. So let's look forward to doing that, yeah? Now become a Pachyeka Buddha first, and then we can do our miracles. Because the biggest miracle of all is becoming a Buddha. So let's perform that miracle first. Become an Arahata Buddha, and then you can do all your miracles. So this Pachyeka Buddha, he performs a miracle. He makes a resolve, as I consume my food, may the child see that I'm actually having the kompitu. May the child see that I'm actually having the kompitu. So he performs his miracle and the child witnesses this. And he rejoices immensely upon sight of this. So the child is elated. He's so happy, so delighted to see that this Buddha is now consuming the food that he has offered. It is that karma that he did on that day that gave him many blissful births in heavens so many times and eventually also gave him birth as Anathapindika or Sudatta in the time of our Gautama Buddha. It proves the point. The object of your offering and the value that it has intrinsically is of no value really in the Buddha Sasana. That is not what you need to concern yourselves with. It is not how big the object is. It is how big your heart is when you make that offering. So this is why the Buddha Sasana is very unique, ladies and gentlemen. It is like none other. It is your intention that always counts. Remember, there were two factors I talked to you about last week that determine the size of your merits. Your intention, as in how pure your intentions are and how pure the receiving party is. In other words, how pure their intentions are. See, on that occasion, the child was making an offering to a Pachyeka Buddha. There is no question about how pure the Pachyeka Buddha's intentions are, right? How much raga, dvesha, moha? Zero. None. The child, of course, there's raga, no dvesha, but some moha in that moment. Because it is out of raga and moha you do merits as well. You need raga to do merits. If you perform an act without raga, or moha, that is actually a kusal. It's not a merit. A kusal is an action that cleanses the mind of defilements. Whereas a merit is something that brings you a comfortable life, including the Dhamma, that will eventually cleanse your mind. So the reason that you are able to listen to the Dhamma today is because of all the merits that you've done in the past out of raga. But that raga was not necessarily a desire to live a blissful life per se, but it would have been a desire to achieve salvation, a desire to achieve freedom, a desire perhaps, you know, one day maybe you offered something to an Arahant, maybe offered something to a Pachika Buddha, maybe offered something to a Buddha long time ago. And that day you made a resolution. May by the power of these merits, as we do at the end of every Dhamma sermon, we do a merit transfer, right? And as we do the merit transfer, what do we always make a resolve? May by the power and the blessings of all these merits, you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Mohanse. In other words, may we become minds that are free of raga, desha and moha. So we resolve a kusal. That is why these merits that you do, they are like none other. Because you don't expect material gains, material possessions out of it. What you expect is freedom from suffering, freedom from all attachment, freedom from all bonds. That is a very unique and very special, very particular type of merit. Those merits help you to free yourself from suffering. The other kind of merits help you to live a comfortable life as you do today. It brings you material gain. It brings you your family. It brings you your friends. It brings you good friends. It brings you trustworthy friends. These are all down to your merits. So the only way that you can take your vipaka with you is if you convert it to karma. Because karma becomes the universal currency that you can take with you no matter where you go. So any sight that you see, any sound that you hear, smell, taste and touch, these are all vipakas, as we discussed last week. Your physical forms, these bodies that you have with you, they're also vipaka. These are all vipakas of karma. What I want to try and explain to you today is how a karma forms. Because once you understand how a karma forms, you realize that you have to be mindful whenever you're doing a karma, so that your karmas will also always be wholesome karma. Wholesome karma will bring you two rewards. One, a comfortable life, that is as you have today. And two, it will help you on the path to your salvation. These two things good karmas will bring you. But what if you do an unwholesome karma? They will bring you misery. They will bring you suffering. Because what you give is what you get. So if ever you are the cause of misery upon others, that misery will come back to you. If you cause grief to others, that grief will come back to you. If you cause suffering upon others, that suffering will come back to you. And I'm going to try and explain to you the phenomenon in which it works. How does it work like that? Because after all, ladies and gentlemen, all of this is just the flow of energy. As much as we like to think of ourselves as human beings and entities and unique identities, all of this is just a collection of energy. You are just a collection of energy. You are mind and body, aren't you? Energy is the ability to do something, isn't it? What is light energy after all? The energy, the ability to illuminate. That is light energy. What is kinetic energy? The ability to move. That is kinetic energy. So whenever you talk about energy, energy is the ability to do something. What is the mind then? I claim it to be an energy. Why is it an energy? It is the ability to do what? The ability to perceive. That is why I refer to it as an energy. It is the ability to perceive. You know what Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana stands for now? Receive, register, recognize, respond and perceive. Right? So the ability to do that is energy in the form of what we call a chitta. That is why I call it an energy. Not I call it an energy, that is why it is an energy. So if you are a chitta and a body, then that is you are simply the ability to do something. Your chitta is the ability to perceive. And then you have your bodies. Your bodies are the matter that you fed in through your mouths, and because of energy, they are held together in a certain way, in a certain order. It doesn't go into chaos because of the energy that you keep pumping yourselves. I promised you, and I have delivered. Welcome to the Montessori. Can you see that? Yes? What is it? Building blocks? That's all you see? Nothing else? A person. Okay. So you see a person.
Right.
What kind of person do you think that is? Can you tell me anything about their gender? You're saying that now because you can see what color I have in my hands right now. What is this? Also a person. What can you tell me about their gender? Huh? Female. How so? Because it's pink. That's why. Okay. Who says? So these are all indoctrinations that we have that have been put into our heads when we were younger, during our formative years. It has been put into our heads that pink is girlish, blue is boyish. This is all data that has been fed into our heads and into our minds. So we grew up with these things thinking that they were true, and now we have made it true. That's the way it is. Otherwise, you know, what is so girlish about pink? What is so feminine about pink? Tell me. What is feminine about pink? There's nothing feminine about pink. What is masculine about blue? There's nothing about it. In fact, none of these things are either pink or blue. These objects, they don't have the colors that you see. Because color is a perception. It is only in your mind. You know, you have the ability to perceive. Yeah? So it is only your ability to perceive that helps you see this as pink. This is not pink. These are just pigments. And these pigments, they have no intrinsic color. This is why, depending on what light you shine on this, what energy you shine on this, the reflection changes accordingly. Now, right now, we have white light falling on this. This is why you say this is pink. If you had a different colored light fall on this, you wouldn't say it's pink. You'd say maybe it's a different a shade of brown, or maybe a dark red, or a violet, or a purple. So therefore, this is not pink. If the circumstances determine what color something is, then it is not that color, is it? Intrinsically? So color is not a characteristic of any object. It is simply what we perceive. Okay? So anyhow, that's not the point I was trying to make.
That is a female, right? As I said, behind every successful man.
So we have a successful man standing at the front. And we have a woman standing behind him. Right, I'll lift this up so you can see it. Okay. Right. So now, you see these two figures, and you've already recognized them as more than just building blocks. All of you? Right, let's see what happened to her, by the way. See, she was actually trying to bear the weight of the man. Huh? It's not easy, is it? She was trying to keep the man upright, and she sacrificed her feet, her legs for that. Ladies in the house, you know exactly what I'm talking about, right? Yes. Right, now, see, this leg, or at least what you think is the leg, when I take it off, you can't help but think that this is actually the leg of this woman. Or this, I'm going to refer to them as a man and woman, okay? Just to keep it simple. These are, of course, only structures, but I'm going to refer to them as such because I want to help you understand a certain point in the Dhamma. So as I take this off, you can't help but think that I've taken this person's leg off. Now, if I take this leg and fix it on this person, how do you feel right now? Something out of place? Yeah? Because this leg belongs to the woman. And now what we've done is we've taken her leg and we've plugged it to this man, and now this is a leg transplant. So this is not his leg. We've taken someone else's leg and we've now connected it to this man. So now you can't help but think that he's actually got someone else's leg. Because you feel that this block belongs to this block. Where is that sense of belonging and ownership coming from? This is what I want you to start to think. A sense of belonging, a sense of ownership is, you perceive it in your mind, where is that coming from? Why do you perceive that? Think about this. See, if I were to now take this all apart, and I take this apart, and take all this apart, and I dismantle this structure, and I do the same with this, see, these are just building blocks. These are just building blocks. But you can't help but feel that they all came from the structures that you saw earlier. So therefore, these are all parts that have come from the man and the woman. Where is that sense of ownership and belonging coming from? In which part of these blocks is a man? So let's take one of the blue parts. Okay, this is one of the blue parts. And it was in the man earlier, right? So what aspect of this tells you that this is a man part? It's just a building block. Does it belong to any structure? Does it belong to any structure? In fact, if we went back to the manufacturing plant where they manufacture these things, right? Do you think the people who manufacture them, the workers there, know that this is going to end up as a leg on a man? Do you think they know this? They don't. So do you think that is what they make this for? No. So there's an agenda that you create for this that does not come with it. This is all because of your sense of belonging, your sense of ownership. You attach things to other things. This is a creation of the mind. And I'll explain to you how it happens and why it happens, and as a result of that, why you suffer. That is the whole reason we're talking about this. If this doesn't lead you to suffering, and the freedom from thinking like this doesn't lead you to freedom from suffering, I wouldn't be talking about it, full stop. The whole reason we're talking about it is because this is why you suffer. Remember I said there's a latent suffering that's always going on in your mind. It's always there. It's constantly there. It is not just when you suffer from a heartache or, you know, a loss or grievance. This is a suffering that is always there. You're always suffering from fear and loss. It's always there. Either one of these two things, because of jati. And that is because you feel that things in this world are connected to something else. They belong to something else. So in our minds, we feel that these things belong to something. Now when I take it and I start piecing it with these pink pieces, you immediately start feeling something awkward. You feel, no, Swaminathan sir, that blue part should go back to the male. The pink part should go back to the female. You can't help but think that. Because now you know that they're all part, they were, to begin with, part of something. And as soon as you saw that as one structure, in your mind, ladies and gentlemen, you placed it all in one structure. You gave it that structure. These were just building blocks that were randomly pieced together. But because we have these mental formations in our minds, we project them to the outside world, and now we expect them to conform to a certain structure, because each of those parts belong to something. this sense of belonging is mind-made. It is not out there. It is because it's not out there, I can now use these pieces to make something entirely different. Now, do I have to make the male and the female structure again, or can I not make something like maybe a train? Can't I do that? Can't I make a castle out of this? Can't I make a bridge out of this, for instance? But how can we use body parts of a person to make a train or a bridge or a castle? Now, as soon as I make, let's make something else. They're a bit flimsy, so I'm going to try and do my best. What might you call this? Your best guess? Be kind. A candle. Thank you, madam. You're very close. Thank you. A dinosaur. Thank you. Right? So, let's go with one of those. Let's go with camel. Right? So now this is a camel. Now when I take this piece off, what am I taking off? The camel's tail. But previously you said I took the woman's foot off. Now you're telling me that I'm taking the camel's tail off. Which one is it? Which one is it? Now you say it depends. What does it depend on? Dependent origination. See, that's why you say it depends. See, the origination of this is dependent. Dependent origination. Therefore, you can never say what this part is intrinsically. This part doesn't belong to anything per se. It is not part and parcel of a certain construct. It is not a part of a certain entity. It is what it is in that moment, isn't it? Pachupan. Whatever the causes are, in that moment, that is what it manifests as. See, this is a manifestation. Now, I'm not going to suggest for one moment that there is no camel here. There is, but there is no entity of a camel. What there is a manifestation. These causes, ladies and gentlemen, are in this moment, only in this moment. It's only valid in this moment. Which moment? At exactly what time? 10:25? No. Time has nothing to do here. Because the Dhamma is a timeless concept. It is nothing to do with time. This is a camel right now because the causes have lined up to manifest as what we call a camel. Conventionally we call it a camel. You could call it whatever you want. It matters not what name you give it. But it has come together in a certain configuration, and now the qualities that they represent, the qualities that they demonstrate, are unique in that way because of the way in which these parts have come together. I'll put this camel to the side for a second. I've got something else for you. This. Another one. And another one. Any guesses what this might be? This is one black piece and two white pieces. Right, I won't tax you. Because it would be unfair to get you to guess what this is. Because how do you know? I mean, honestly, how can you know? Because this origination was dependent, the causes for that were in this mind. So how can you know what this is? This is two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom. Now what is this? Water. And this? Two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom. Again. Two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom. Again. What do you have now? Three molecules of water. Okay? Alright, so let's put the water to a side. Before we go to that. So this is water. What are some of the characteristics of water? It boils at 100 degrees Celsius. It flows. Yeah. So at room temperature, it's a liquid. Let's just take one characteristic. At room temperature, it's a liquid. We all are in agreement with that. Okay. So this is two hydrogens and one oxygen. Now what is this? Now what is this at room temperature? A gas. Another one. Another hydrogen. What is this? Oxygen. Two oxygen atoms together. You have oxygen. What are these three? These are the same blocks that I took earlier. Yes? These are the same blocks. So I had two black blocks and I had four white blocks. And this is the same blocks that I took earlier, but it's a different configuration. Now what is it at room temperature? It's a gas. The moment you rearrange things and give it a different configuration, you won't even see it. Because water you can see with your naked eyes, but hydrogen and oxygen, you can't see them because they have different characteristics. Now then tell me, is it the water that became oxygen and hydrogen? Is it the water that became the... So are these the water atoms? Are these the water atoms? Are they water atoms only now in a different configuration? No. Exactly. These are just causes in a different arrangement. The same causes. So when it was water, it was just the same atoms configured in a different way, a different alignment and therefore different properties. So you see, all you have in life, ladies and gentlemen, is just matter in different arrangements, different configurations. And when they take different configurations, they have different qualities. They have different properties. They express themselves in different ways. And that's exactly what this is. So now, if I take one of these oxygens. Let's take a water bag actually. Let's feed this to the camel. Yeah, so we're going to feed. What are we going to feed the camel? Water. Okay, we're going to feed the camel water. So when this water goes into the camel, right, it consumes the water, what's going to happen to these atoms? They're going to decompose. That's what's going to happen. Yeah, that's why it's called decomposing. What is this? What am I doing right now? Composing. You compose music? Yeah? You bring different notes together and you compose something, don't you? But that composition is a manifestation. Because individually all you have are the discrete elements that there are. None of the notes in a music script know that they are part of that script. That is the nature of a composition. They're just there as manifestation. In the same manner, these elements, they don't know that they are part of water. They're just atoms. So they are composed in a particular order. Now, when we feed this water to the camel, what the camel's body does is it digests this. The process of digestion, as you do it, is merely breaking down compositions. Rather, in other words, decomposing things so that you can compose them in other ways. See? Now what happened to the water molecule? Now it has become part of the camel. Can I not take this all back? So now in certain countries they eat camel. Have you eaten camel? No? You should try it. I'm just kidding. In some countries they eat camel. Right? So when they eat camel, what do? they take the camel meat, right, and they cook it. Because cooking helps the decomposition process. That's why we cook our food. If you just put your food without cooking it into your bodies will really struggle to decompose it. Understand and remember, understand what I'm trying to mean here by the word decomposition. Because typically when we think about decomposition, we think of something that's rotting or going off, right? Like, you know, something, some food that you leave outside and starts to decompose, and that's the idea that you get. And you start getting all sorts of, you know, noxious fumes and so on. But what I really mean by decomposition is, this is a composition. As pieces start coming off, this is decomposition. But they decompose and then we ingest it. So first we digest it and then we ingest it. After ingestion has happened, these things are recomposed. I don't think I showed you the video of how digestion works. Did I? Not in this sermon. Next week, we'll do that. So then it will really, you'll really hit the nail on the head. The penny will drop for a lot of you when you realize that all you're doing is just putting the stuff that makes you through your mouths so that they are broken down and then recombined to form what you are. So see, now we've decomposed and then we've composed something else. So this is now camel meat. Right? So camel meat, we cook. Okay? So this is now camel meat. We've now cooked the camel. And we are now going to serve it. Serve it to whom? Aha. What are you going to serve it to? Our friends from earlier. Remember them? This is all camel meat. This is all camel meat. We are back where we started. So is it camel meat now? What are you? Then you must be goats and chickens. Because that's what most of you eat. Are you what you eat? If you are what you eat as an entity, then your carrots and beans and tomatoes and potatoes and chickens and fish, and cows and all sorts, and pigs. But it would not be right to call you by those names because it's offensive. Is that why? No, that's not what I'm talking about here. It would not be right to call you by those names because these configurations we don't call by those names. These configurations we refer to as human beings. That is merely a reconfiguration, a recombination, a recomposition of the very things that you put in through your mouths. You have a fantastic digestive system and an ingestion system. What it does is it breaks down whatever you eat and recombines it, reforms it, recomposes it into what you are. So then would it be right to call things, well, you can call things by a name, but ladies and gentlemen, is it right to think, to perceive what you see as a fixed entity? Here's the question. This is the ultimate question I have to ask you after explaining all that. Is it right to call the things that you see by a name? That's fine, we have to refer to them with names. But to think that these are fixed entities and they will never change. A camel is a camel is a camel is a camel. Is that right? A carrot is a carrot is a carrot. Is that right? Because as soon as you consume it, it's no longer a carrot. So fish is fish is fish. Is that right? No. But when you look at it, you get this feeling, you get this perception that they are fixed entities. You feel this concept that these are fixed things. And when you have this idea that what you see out there are fixed entities, when you have this notion, here's what happens next. The 11 great fires come next. We talked about death last week, remember? See, if this is your loved one, okay, but it is all composed of the camel meat that they ate earlier, but you see them and you think that this is one individual, this is an entity. Now, when this happens, what's happened? Now they are broken. What you don't see is merely an arrangement. This is just an arrangement of matter. You think of this as belonging to this. Therefore, you see that this is broken. Now, here's what else happens. If someone were to hold your hand, is that okay? You can't answer that question because you'll say again, it depends. What if it's a total stranger? It's not okay. What if it's someone you know? Still, it depends. Because just because I know doesn't mean they can hold my hand. But let's say you walk into a restaurant and you're sat in at one table, right? Opposite you is a complete strange guy, right? You don't know this person. You both eat at the same restaurant, all three meals, let's assume. So this is the only place where you take your food. You don't take food anywhere else. The two of you always come to the same restaurant and you eat the same food. Now, what has gone into making the bodies? The same food, cooked by the same chefs. Yeah, it's the same rice, it's the same curries, the same gravies, the same everything. Even the salt has come from the same bottle. Right? So everything has come from the same source. But as they eat it, as you eat it, as they eat it, these things go into form these bodies, your body and their body. Yeah? But now, if they were to reach out and hold your hand, just randomly, what are you going to do? Chances are you're just going to pull back and go, oh, hold on, why are you holding my hand? You're a stranger, don't touch me. Because you feel that that hand, that arm, that body is actually a very separate entity. But is it not the same stuff that went into your mouth as well? Is it not the same stuff that went into making you as well? It's just you both ate two halves from the same rice bowl. But when it was the same rice, it didn't matter which part you served yourself, did it? See, when you're at the restaurant and you go to serve yourself, if it's a buffet, you go to serve yourself, it doesn't matter which side of the dish you take your rice from, does it? Because at that point, all you see is rice. You think this is rice. But after you've eaten it, now it goes into making these bodies of yours, and now you say, now this is my body, and that is their body. At which point did that distinction become? I want you to try to get your minds to thinking that, you know, these are all projections of your own mind, ladies and gentlemen. Start to think about it along these lines. Because otherwise what happens is, you get into conflict. As well as get into states of desire. Now tell me, if you're a man, when you see a woman, or if you're a woman and you see a man, do you know why desire rises in your mind? When you've both eaten from the same rice bowl? So why don't you have these thoughts when you look at the rice bowl? Just think about it. Think sensibly. It's time to start thinking sensibly. Because we've never thought in this manner, in this way, ever before. So it's time to start thinking sensibly. This is the same food that we're all eating. This is a carrot, let's say. I give you one half of the carrot, and I give you the other half of the carrot. So the men in the room, I give one half. The women in the room, I give the other half. The same carrot. And then you eat it. After you've eaten it, it goes into making parts of your bodies. Maybe your skin, let's say. And then, one person that has the skin that was made from this carrot, and then there's the other person that has the skin that was made of this carrot, they look at each other's skin and they go, ah, beautiful. Why? Where does that come from? See, once you begin to understand the reality of the Dhamma, there is no room for desire. That is why it's called a fire that needs to be extinguished. And the Dhamma is the water that extinguishes it. So the only reason that when you see a man or a woman, you have feelings of lust or desire, is because you are ignorant of the truth. You live a lie. You think the same carrot going into two bodies have gone into making two distinct identities, two distinct individuals. Whereas what's really happened is the same carrot has just been reconfigured. It's just a carrot, just reconfigured. You no longer call it carrot, you call it man and woman. These are just conventional terms. We don't need to dish away with the conventional terms, we have to use them because configurations have their own names, and that's fine. See, one of the 11 great fires is the fire of desire. The other great fire, one of the other 11 great fires, is the fire of aversion. Another great fire is the fire of delusion. These are 3 of the 11. Then there are 8 more. Jara, Vyadi, Marana, Shoka, Parideva, Dukkha, Domanasa, Upayasa. Eleven great fires. Lamentation, grief, discontentment, dissatisfaction. All of these fires come into your mind because you feel that these are entities that have been formed. Because you ignore the fact that all this is are just manifestations of the same stuff, just reconfigured. Reconfigured energies, reconfigured matter. That's all it is, ladies and gentlemen. But the mind wishes to see entities. So therefore it projects entities out to the outside world. And therefore you look around this room and you see flowers, you see Swami Mahanse, you see a board, you see lights, you see the furniture, you see other people sat around you. The problem is not with you physically seeing them. The problem is with you mentally perceiving them as fixed units. Therefore, when things happen to them, you feel that they are breaking, they are dying, they are decaying, they are falling ill, and all sorts. These things don't really happen. They are only creations of your own perceptions. That is why the Buddha says that suffering is entirely self-made. You only suffer because you are not wise to the truth. So this is an appeal for you to come to your senses. Open your wisdom eyes and begin to realize the reality of what things really are. Stop punishing yourselves is what I ask you. Stop punishing yourselves. Don't you think you're punishing yourselves? I started right at the beginning of the talk. You know, when you feel desire, when you feel lust, right, just because you grow old is not going to stop. Don't fool yourselves. Some people think, you know, it's only because we are young, we have to fight with these urges, but after we grow old, it's all going to stop. Oh no. Oh no. Have you not seen old people, old men? You know, they have a desire that can't be quenched. And sometimes, you know, they get into all sorts of trouble. And you think how dirty they are. Sometimes you might even want to punish them and lock them up and beat them down. All I'm thinking is, poor child. That's all I'm thinking. Poor child. Like I said, the Dhamma connects me with everyone. All I see is a mind that has not grasped the Dhamma. Therefore, I mean, how can you punish someone for their ignorance? If your child at home breaks something that is really precious to you, okay, because they decide to play with it, right? This is what, 6-year-old, They decide to play ball in the living room, and they throw the ball at the TV because it bounces it back. So they throw it at the TV, and the TV cracks. They're ignorant, aren't they, of how valuable and precious these things are? What do you do to the child? You give it a good beating. Do you? 6-year-old? No. As a responsible adult, you need to realize the child only did that because he's a child. Right, so even when you get angry, maybe your other half will come and say, come on, it's just a child. How is the child going to understand this stuff? So what do you do is you take the child to a side and instead of beating him or making him cry, you say, Puta, that's a TV. This is a ball. We don't play inside the living room. When you want to play, you go out and play because otherwise things break. Right? So sometimes that's going to be an expensive lesson. But if you now hit the child, you have not only broken the TV. It's not just a broken TV set you have now. You also have a broken mind. Now the child falls out with you. They don't like you anymore. So it's better to just teach the child because you don't punish ignorance. Yes, of course, ignorance, you know, you can't use ignorance as an alibi in a court of law. That, granted. But generally, we don't punish people when they're ignorant about something. You know, someone says, someone turns up late. You ask them, why are you late? Oh, first, before asking them, you just have a go at them because they're late. And then they listen to everything you have to say. And then they tell you, I'm sorry, but you didn't give me a chance to tell you. The reason I was late was because I had to run an errand for your wife. I was meaning to get to work on time, but then your wife rang and she said, please take this lunch for you. So I had to go and fetch it from your house and then bring it for you. That is why I was late. Oh, you should have told me. And then you start shouting at them again. What for? For not having told you why they were late? Well, you didn't give them a chance. Now, don't you feel embarrassed? You do. Because you are now telling someone, oh, for no fault of theirs, they were ignorant of something, or rather you were ignorant of something, so therefore you can't be told off for that because you're ignorant. So now when that Siya, he gets beaten up in a bus, right, or on the train or whatever, because he went and rubbed himself against some young lady because he couldn't control his urges, because he couldn't control his lust. All I can say is ignorance. Because once they're ignorant, they can't help but see a woman. I mean, if you see women and men, why don't they? They will also see that. Until you understand the Dhamma, you're going to not see carrots reconfigured. You're going to see men, women, ladies and gentlemen. That's what you're going to see. And then once you start seeing them, you'll have either raga or dvesha. You will either like them or you will dislike them. This is the nature of the world, ladies and gentlemen. We just need to come to our senses and realize this. So this is what I try to prove to you with the hydrogens and the oxygens. As you know, these are only their configurations give them certain characteristics. That much you understand, don't you? There are these configurations afford them certain characteristics. Water is not the same as hydrogen and oxygen together, is it? When you have some hydrogen, when you have some oxygen, and you bring it all together, do they now behave like water? Do they? No, because the configuration has not changed. It's just more of the same stuff. For it to take on the characteristics of water, you have to take it apart and combine them in a different order, in a different configuration. Now, it's not just a lot of hydrogen and a lot of oxygen. It's now water. A different property, different characteristics, because it's a different manifestation. But it would be wrong to think that it is the hydrogen that has become the water or the oxygen that has become the water. Because there was no hydrogen or oxygen or water statically. They were simply dynamic forces acting on each other. These atoms had forces acting on them that kept them in that order, and therefore they manifested as certain properties, chemicals or molecules, and therefore they had certain properties. So the same concept I wish for you to apply to all things that you see around you. When you see a body of any sort, this is also a body. Right? If you see Swamin Mahanse right now, and you think you're looking at a man, you think that you're looking at a person, take a moment to contemplate on the fact that this is just the stuff that was put in through the mouth and then broken down and rearranged in a certain way. And if you can contemplate on that, for one split second, ladies and gentlemen, you will stop seeing a person here. Try it right now. Try and stop seeing me as a human being. Stop seeing this body as a human body. Stop seeing this body as a male's body and just see it as matter reconfigured. Just try and do it for a second. In that one moment, you will recognize that this is just matter held together with energy. So therefore, if the arrangement changes in some way, it's okay because it's an arrangement in some way anyway. So if this arm comes off, it's not an arm coming off from a body. It's just matter being rearranged because of energy being applied to it. See, if you apply enough energy on this part of the body, can't you pull it off? You can. I mean, it would be a gruesome sight, but nonetheless, you can do it. All you need is energy, because it's the moment you apply energy, matter begins to change configuration. That's all that happens. When you cook, that's what happens. When this drops on the floor, what happens? Right now there's potential energy. Potential energy is determined by the height between this object and the floor. So as I drop it, that energy translates to kinetic energy. And that energy, as it comes onto the, and as it makes contact with the ground, what happens is that energy is absorbed by the molecules that make this object. And as soon as those molecules absorb that energy, what do they start to do? They also start to move. And if they move enough, what happens? The bonds between those molecules break. And therefore you say it's broken. See, a little bit of physics is useful. And a little bit of chemistry is useful. So whatever you've learned for your sciences, you know, this is all good stuff. You can apply it now to the concepts of Dhamma. The further you understand the Dhamma, the more you will realize that the Buddha was the best scientist there ever was. But he didn't do experimentation to learn things. Because that is the power of his mind. He just thinks about things and the truth comes to him. Whereas for us, scientists, we have to experiment. We have to analyze results. We have to come up with hypotheses. And then we have to keep on that cycle and use the scientific method to eventually come to the truth. But the Buddha didn't eventually come to the truth. He started with the truth. And to this day, the Dhamma has come from generation to generation to generation, and maybe by now it's distorted in some ways. Some people will not hold the absolute pristine truth that the Buddha taught back then. Because, you know, as the Dhamma flows from mouth to mouth, you know, people add things and take out things. Because it is not the pure-hearted that do it all the time. It's not a saint that always practices and delivers the Dhamma all the time. By the Buddha's preaching, one must at least become a noble one before they start preaching. Because otherwise, what is your understanding of the Dhamma? Otherwise, you're just teaching something that you have memorized. You've learnt it from someone else and you start preaching it. How do you know whether it is true for you? If you have no conviction in the Dhamma, then you cannot convince someone that this is the truth. You can let them, you can teach them to memorize it, but they will never understand it or comprehend it. But then, you know, in this day and age, if all Swamin Mahanses had to wait until they became noble ones to start preaching, you know, there wouldn't be any monks preaching any sermons at all. Because where do the monks have time now to practice the Dhamma? Because people, that is not what people want from them. People want them to run the country for them. People want them to run businesses for them. People want them to run organizations for them. Think about it. What do most people go to monks and ask advice for? How to pass the exams. How to bring good luck. This is not what monks are for. They have committed their lives to practicing the noble path and freeing themselves from suffering. That is what we should use them for. so that they can do that for themselves and they can help us do the same. But when we start to distract them from their noble path, because it can easily happen, if they're surrounded by ignoble association, people who just want material gains, material possessions, and you know, going from place to place in life, if that is all they are surrounded with, then Swaminarayan says we'll stop practicing the Dhamma and they'll start helping people out and doing social service. It's not bad doing social service, but if that is all they end up doing, sabba dukkha nissarana nibbana sacca karanattaya e sankhasavam gahetva pabba jetamyam bhante anukampang upadaya. You will hear these words on Tuesday as our Anagarika Mahatyas will be beseeching their robes from their teachers. The meaning of those words, ladies and gentlemen, is I want to free myself from all suffering. Sabba dukkha nissarana nibbana sacca karanattaya. To accomplish Nibbana, etam kasavam gahetva, please take these robes and then return it to me so that I might fulfill my path and become an arahant. That is how all monks come into the sasana. Unfortunately, that is not how all monks leave the sasana. And they are not wholly to blame for that. Partly yes, but not wholly. As lay disciples, we must be careful how we associate monks. Because if not, the merits that they have brought along with them to attain Nibbana and help us along the way, if we start to sidetrack them and distract them from that path, what refuge do we have, ladies and gentlemen? When there are individuals who are happy to commit their whole lives to practicing the path, you know, and then they discover the Dhamma, they practice the Dhamma, and they preach it to us, don't they? See, if I didn't have the time to practice the Dhamma, where would you be learning the Dhamma from? So, gladly, we never find ourselves in the association of our devotees who ever come to us and talk about anything else other than Nibbana. In that way, I can only thank my lucky stars. I'm so fortunate in that way. All of us at the monastery. Whenever you come to the monastery, whenever we meet and discuss about something, we're always talking about Nibbana for ourselves or somebody else. Directly or indirectly, always geared towards Nibbana. But I don't think every monk has that privilege in this day and age. More monks are disrobing by the day than monks, than people coming into robes. It has become such a pity. But you can't just blame the monks for that. Because after all, if they are the people who are there to teach us the Dhamma and show us the path to salvation, the fewer of them in robes, what hope is there going to be left for us? What do you think? If fewer of them are in robes, I think less than 20,000, something like that, maybe between 20 and 25,000 are the number of monks in Sri Lanka now. Just imagine what a small number that is. It's nothing. 20 million people in this country, 20,000 monks. Soon enough, we will have numbers we can count on our 10 fingers. That's going to happen eventually. So how can you help that? How can you help prevent that? By committing yourself to Nibbana. And when you associate with monks, Talk about the Dhamma, talk about Nibbana, talk about your salvation. Don't go to them for other things. Because for that we have all sorts of other people there to help. You can go to the Devala if you want a blessing from the gods, can't you? You can go to the doctor if you are physically unwell. I'm not suggesting that you're doing these things, but I'm saying, you know, even in the future, if you ever think of seeking help from the Swaminarayan says or whatever, try and always make that request geared and centered towards anchored in Nibbana. Because if they stop doing Nibbana, if our monks stop doing Nibbana, ladies and gentlemen, if the Buddha Sravaka stop doing Nibbana, oh boy, we will be lost for good. Because we, as lay people, we depend on them to practice the path, devote themselves to that path, right, and then help us and guide us so that we can do it as much as we can in our lay lives. Am I right? Yeah. So let's not distract them. I don't know how I got to that point. But, you know, this is good advice nonetheless. I'm not for one moment suggesting that you are like that, but I don't ever want you to be someone who drags a monk who's gone into robes to practice the Dhamma away from that path and into something worldly. Because there are enough and more people doing worldly things. In fact, the Buddha has even laid down codes of conduct for the Swaminarayanas, and he said, you know, don't indulge and engage yourself in worldly affairs. Because if you do so, that will distract you from the path of Nibbana. So commit yourself to the path of Nibbana. And that doesn't mean constantly 24/7 practicing the Dhamma and or meditation. That's not what it means. There's a certain amount of work that you have to do to serve the community that you're in. You know, these are things that we have to do. But whenever you're doing it, as monks, we should always be mindful, what is the ultimate purpose of this? Is it to make money? Is it to gain fame? Is it to get to places? Is it for property? Is it for wealth? Is it for glory? Is it for power? Is it for authority? These are questions that we monks have to ask ourselves. Or is it purely to get to Nibbana and help as many people get there as well? If that is your intention, ultimately, chetanaham bhikkave kammam vadami. If that is your intention, no problems. So, as lay devotees, I urge you, whenever you have an engagement, interaction with Swaminarayanas or Mehininarayanas, right, whatever the case might be, you can't be a judge as to what they do and whether what they're doing is right or wrong. But if you know that what you're going to talk to them about, if what you're going to deal with them about is not to do with Nibbana, then pick someone else to sort that out. They're not Kattariyas. Swaminarayanas are not Kattariyas. They have come into the sasana to attend Nibbana. Let them do that. And get their help to achieve the same for yourselves. Like I said once again, I'm just so glad and so fortunate that at our monastery, we have created an organization, a system in a way, whereby every interaction and engagement we have with all of you has always been and is always and will always continue to be beneficial for both of us. Beneficial in terms of helping us on our path to Nibbana. Because that is the only thing that is worth achieving after all. Everything else we have to leave behind. Then what's the point? Let's say you go to a Swaminarayanas and you get his help to pass your A-levels. And you pass it with flying colors. Is this the first time you're doing it? Is this going to be the last time you're doing it? No. Then what's the blooming point? Here's what you can do. Go to the Swaminarayanas and say, Swaminarayanas, I'm going to be doing my A-levels. Can you teach me how this can be the last time I have to do it? Help me with my A-levels so I don't have to do it again. That help you can get from him. Then he'll teach you how you never have to do it again. That is good help to get from a monk. So, with your blessings as well, we have 7 other young men who will be going into robes on Tuesday. One of whom is very familiar and known to you. So, once again, you're all very welcome on Tuesday. We'll have the ordination ceremony. It's meant to begin at around... what time? 7 o'clock, isn't it? Yes. So, if you can make your way there for 7 a.m., then you'll be there in good time. So, what should you do when you're there? Take selfies and put them on Facebook. You can do that if you want to do that. But there's something more that I want you to do. Every story I have read of an arahant, in fact, most stories, I can't say every story, but virtually every story I've read about arahants, their first resolve to become an arahant was made on an occasion where they saw someone else going into robes and engaging on that path. So you're going to witness, and I can vouch for one thing, that these young men who are going to go into robes, ladies and gentlemen, they have not come into the sasana because they have nowhere else to go. They have not come into the sasana because they need someone to look after them when they're elderly. Oh no. That much I can promise you. Because we vet and we check and we scrutinize each and every one of them. And we know one thing for certain, that none of them are homeless or were homeless when they came into the sasana. None of them were destitute other than destitution from samsara. Right? None of them were people who had nowhere else to go and they, you know, their children didn't look after them and therefore they needed somewhere, an orphanage to go and be at, or an old people's home to go and be at. That's not what they wanted. They've all come with a good understanding of the Dhamma. So I can vouch for one thing. Each and every one of these men, they will be aspiring to Nibbana. They'll want to achieve that for themselves. And they'll understand that to do it for themselves, they must also help others to do that. So become part of that force. Become part of that energy. So as you're there and you pass on your blessings, I want you all to make a resolve. As these young men have been fortunate enough today to walk in the footsteps of the great master and to don the robe that he bestowed upon humanity, may I as well one day be able to receive that good fortune. I want you to make that resolve there. Do that. As Guru Hamar always tells us, a resolution, a determination that is made when the mind is pure is usually a determination, a resolution that will come true. So when your mind is pure and you make a resolve for something, you determine for something, if your mind is pure, pure of raga, pure of desha, pure of moha, then those determinations are very powerful. They tend to become reality. So when you're there on Tuesday, make that resolve for yourselves. For some of you, it may not happen in this lifetime. So be it. I can't change that. But not all of us started in this lifetime. Some of us, we started long time ago. Perhaps this is the first time I've become a monk in the recent past of samsara. But I can tell you one thing, this will not have been the first time I resolved to become a monk. Accumulation of merits each time, every time, has eventually brought me this opportunity. I want you all to be that. I want you all to be part of that. So don't you ever give up. Don't you ever feel it's too late for me. I should have done it when I was younger. Right? You know, some of you, you're still young. There's enough life left in all of you to attain Nibbana. Enough and more life left in all of you. All that is required is you to take action. Remember, your life is your most valuable asset. It is your most valuable asset. It's not the money you have earned. It's not the property that you have. It's not your family. Your life is your most valuable asset. Ensure that you use it wisely. Use it so that it benefits you. Use it that it brings you rewards. Use it wisely. A day lived, a single day lived wisely, in contemplation, lived morally, is more valuable than 100 years of having lived an immoral life. 100 years lived foolishly. 100 years having lived simply in vexing and relieving oneself of vexation for the sake of pleasure. 100 years lived like that is a waste of time in comparison to a single day on which you live contemplatively. So I urge you all to do that. Please don't undervalue yourselves. Please don't undermine yourselves. If you do that to yourselves, nobody else is going to correct you. Nobody else is going to give you value that you're not going to give yourselves. So please, understand how precious your lives are. You have been born in an era where the Buddha's Dhamma prevails. You have been born in an era where I know for a fact that the Dhamma is so potent. It can do so much. It can heal. It can deliver you from suffering. I know this, ladies and gentlemen, because I speak from first-hand experience. The smile on my face is as genuine as it can be. I am not pretending to be happy. I am. I know where I was, and I know where I am now today. And therefore, I know where I can be in a few years' time. So I speak with sheer conviction. If I can do it, you can do it. It's never too late for any of you. If your hearts are still breathing, beating, if you are still breathing, if there's still blood running in your veins, and if you can understand these words that I speak to you, then wake up and take every opportunity to make the right resolutions, make the right determinations. You have the new year coming just around the corner. What a fantastic time to make such a resolve. How fortunate must you be, just as the turn of the new year, where people around the world are making new goals, new ambitions, and setting themselves up for the new year. You'll be there at the monastery, just, you know, the same week going, where you'll be making a resolve. May by these merits, as these young men have accumulated enough blessings and merits to travel the path and enter the path to Nibbana, may I also be able to do that. How fortunate must you be to be privileged to be in such a position. And as I said, I can give you every guarantee that those young men are doing it genuinely. They're not doing it out of force. No one's forcing them to do it. They're not running away from poverty. No, no, no. They come from very good families, very respectable people, very accomplished people. Some of them have traveled the world. They were going as far as life could take them when they heard the Dhamma. And then 180 degree turn around. And they all came back and entered the monastery. You will hear their stories on that day. They'll give you a short profile of where they were and how the Dhamma changed them and transformed them. Pay attention to them when they speak. And see if you can relate to those stories. See if it strikes a chord with you. It's all available. Make use of it. It's all there for the taking. The Dhamma is here, the Buddha is here, the Mahasangha is here. What else do you need? Huh? You have your merits. You're good people. You're good-hearted, kind-hearted, good-will people. What more do you need? Don't wait until it's too late. Don't ever regret, because you needn't. So bear that in mind and make the most of what you have. Let's conclude for today. Dhamma heals. I forgot I had a cough. Okay. Let's take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired and bring today's sermon to a close. First and foremost then, let us remind ourselves how extremely fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, let us transfer these merits to them, for it is they who have preserved and protected the teachings of the Buddha out of their own practice and passing it along from generation to generation in the noble lineage, in the form of the Tripitaka, which is available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer this message to the friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who contribute to the construction of the monastery, to those who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. May by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers,
Husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employees and our employees, our teachers, our elders, those who've gone every length to help make our lives better and shape our lives for the better. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmanas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to protect and preserve the sum of the sasana. Let us also transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our loved ones who have passed away in our name. Those who have predeceased us, our ancestors, our forefathers. It is in their bloodshed and sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts that we do and practice the path in peace and harmony. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to those who make great sacrifices for the peace and harmony of our nation. This includes the members of the armed forces as well as the police force, as well as people who have lost their lives in the war, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives from natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, and pandemics, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us, people who will have gone every mile to help us, support us, and assist us in every single way. Therefore, out of compassion and gratitude towards all of them, let us take a moment to transfer all the merits that we have acquired towards them. May they all rejoice in these merits, and if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we will witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahatiranin Mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnen midetva, dvesha ginnen midetva, moha ginnen midetva, nibbana parama sukhayen. Sukhita taravitma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravitma Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravitma Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravitma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravitma Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivan sapalabeva Nivan sapalabeva Nivan sapalabeva Tunruvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen Silo loka silo satyoma Nibbana Paramasukhen Sukhitara Vetva. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I recognize that next week is the 31st, but because it's, we only have it in the morning, I think we are still good to do the talk. But what I will do is I'll finish on time. I'll try and do that for once next week, because I think it's only right that we do so, because I know there'll be your friends and family who will want to spend the rest of the day with you. And although I also feel that you are part of my family, you also have other families to spend your time with. Until they all start to feel part of this family one day, then we can all spend the 31st night together. Because there is actually a program at the monastery on the 31st night. And believe you me, many hundreds of people, they come to the monastery and they spend the 31st night at the monastery. We dawn the new year at the monastery, chanting the Karmasthana, reflecting on Arya Maitreya, and contemplating on noble metta. That is what we do. Where a lot of people out there will be partying, nothing wrong with that necessarily, but they'll be indulging in sensuality and aversion and delusion and desire. What we try and do is use that energy that people have on that special day to convert that to something powerful, something useful, something productive, not just to ourselves but to the human race. So we do that every day, every year. On the dawn of the new year, we have that. So one day, you can also join us at the monastery. But I'm not asking you to do that this time round. You'll have friends and family you'll have to be with. They'll expect you to be with them. And so please do so. Okay? When you have duties and responsibilities, if you don't fulfill them, then that is not good either. As good Buddhists, that is also part and parcel of us being a good Buddhist. But we'll have the sermon next Sunday. And I'll finish on time. They don't sound nice.